the kids. They don't go to school functions with the kids. They don't take the kids in a weekend for a hamburger. It is affecting themselves, their family, and their communities to a great extent.
I wanted to ask you, Teresa, there are some farm worker advocacy groups, for instance, like the group Somos Poder del Pueblo, We Are the Power of the People, that are calling for a more militant response, possibly a nationwide strike of farm workers in response to Trump's attacks. And they've circled the dates of July 16th to the 18th. What is the United Farm Workers' view of this kind of action at this point?
Involved in this action. Look, we empower workers to do what they think it is the best thing to do to protect their rights. We know from experience, and you know our history, that a strike takes a lot of discipline, a lot of work and engagement, a lot of commitment, and a lot of time to plan and organize. So, although we see what they're doing, this is not something that we're involved. If we ever get to a point where we're going to do that, it would take a lot of planning, looking at the pros and cons under the circumstances. So, all I'm asking is whoever's going to be out there to just be careful. We don't want these people that are fighting for others to be retaliated against and detained by us.
Teresa Romero, we want to thank you for being with us. Long time
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found at our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Support for KBOO comes from our members and from Metropolitan Family Services Cash Oregon, committed to improving the financial health of low to moderate income families and individuals by providing free tax preparation services. Volunteers are currently needed to support this program. All training is provided and no tax experience is necessary. More info on volunteering at cashoregon.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland activists will go to City Council tonight at 5 p.m. to witness the City Council meeting at 6 and encourage discussion of the ICE permit and violations.
On Thursday, July 18th, 350 PDX will host a Shade Equity bike ride starting at 6 at Lentz Park, to showcase the power of shade in the neighborhoods.
An Oregon poet, Dan Raphael, brings us poetic justice.
Good evening. This is KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, July 16th, 2025. I am Cheryl Denise.
And I'm Hannah Francis. During tonight's City Council meeting, activists plan to meet outside City Hall and ask City Council to focus their efforts on revoking the permit that allows ICE to continue operations at the Southwest McAdam Portland facility. Several violations of ICE's permit to operate within the city have been brought forward in testimony and in articles coming out this month. KPTV reported that federal immigration authorities may have violated the conditions of a city permit at their Portland facility more than two dozen times. The permit allows ICE to operate in the facility under strict conditions. One of these strict rules is that no detainees may be held for more than 12 hours in the facility. ICE's detention records show that there were at least 28 instances of ICE detaining individuals for over 12 hours in the facility. In 20 of those cases, detainees were held for more than 24 hours. The protests have been continuing for over a month outside of the Southwest Macadam ICE facility, which has been shut down and reopened. The Community and Public Safety Committee held two meetings on the subject so far this month, the last one being over 2 hours of public testimony. Now, activists hope to bring discussion of the permit to City Council as a whole, making it known that the situation is urgent to the people. The organizers will meet outside of City Council chambers at 5 p.m. today and will observe the City Council meeting in person from 6 to 9 p.m.
Climate data reveals Oregon has had increasingly more days over 90 degrees than we have had in the last 10 years. Experts believe this trend is likely to continue in the years ahead. It's hot right now. Southern Oregon was predicted to experience triple-digit temperatures today, with the Willamette Valley and Central and Eastern Oregon expected to be in the 90s. State climatologist Larry O'Neill said, "Over the last few years, we have experienced almost double the number of these hot days compared with historical occurrences." According to National Weather Service data, the number of 90-degree days in Portland since 1940 has certainly climbed. On average, Portland has averaged about 17 days above 90 degrees each year. Over the last several years, we've been averaging between around 20 to 25 days above 90 degrees. And it's not just Oregon that is warming. This likely reflects the effect of an overall increase in global temperature on our local climate. The burning of fossil fuels like coal, oil, and natural gas continues to drive human-caused climate change. The resulting greenhouse gas emissions trapped in the atmosphere raise average temperatures and result in extreme weather events. Our summer nights are getting warmer. Since 1940, those temperatures have increased by about 5.4 degrees. That makes it harder for people to recover from high temperatures during the day. That could lead to serious heat-related health risks, like heat exhaustion or heat stroke. An extreme heat advisory is still in effect through this evening.
On Thursday, July 17th, 350 PDX will host a Pedalpalooza bike ride to showcase the impact of shade on the livability of neighborhoods. This is an annual bike ride that changes slightly every year as the shade landscape changes in Portland. The group will gather at 6 p.m. at Lenz Park, where two city staff will come and talk about the state of trees at the city level. The ride will begin at 6:30 and end at Laurelhurst Park around 7:30. At the end of the bike ride, there will be a regular 350 PDX action night at the park with food, drinks, and an auction. The weather is currently projected to be around 86 degrees at the time of the ride. Organizers are encouraging the bikers to prioritize health and safety and to bring plenty of water and sunscreen. Shade equity is a term that refers to the equitable distribution of trees and their shade throughout the city so that there is not only shade in wealthy communities but also in low-income and middle-class neighborhoods. The heat dome in 2021 killed almost 100 people across the state. Studies released since have revealed that the areas in Portland where people were most affected did not have adequate vegetation. Shade equity can improve lives and all of those living in the community, cooling streets and houses.
Oregon will begin training state government employees on how to use generative artificial intelligence. The state's Enterprise Information Services, which oversees the government's software systems, will begin offering AI courses to state employees. As part of our commitment to building an informed and capable public service workforce, the state is working with Innovate US, a nonprofit that has worked with government agencies to provide no-cost AI training for public sector employees. Governor Kotek said, "We cannot ignore the rapid growth of AI in our lives. It is incumbent on government to ensure new technology is used responsibly, ethically, and securely." The online courses will be available to all state employees but are not currently required.
The Willamette Week seems to be perplexed by the new city council. The lead article in the current Willamette Week is titled, "One Thing Has Changed in Portland City Hall. The Socialists Are Setting the Agenda," and has an illustration with the question, "Better off red?" The article delves into some of the principles of the Democratic Socialists of America, otherwise known as DSA, and the group's four members on Portland City Council: Angelita Murillo, Tiffany Cuyamalane, Mitch Green, and Samir Kanal. The DSA's vision of a better Portland includes free garbage pickup, free buses and trains, government-run grocery stores with price control, and a downtown with some office towers replaced by subsidized housing. This would be paid for by residents with a high income. The actual number is not yet set. While the article says the local DSA has only around 2,000 members, it says nothing about how much support their proposed programs have.
Recovery from the Rowena fire in the Columbia Gorge that destroyed 56 homes is still underway, and the local food bank has been a leader in the effort, distributing food, water, and supplies. Isobel Charley has more on that story.
Fire in Oregon's Columbia Gorge was put out, and the local food bank remains vital to recovery efforts. The fire burned 3,600 acres in Wasco County, destroying 56 homes and 100 other structures. Breen Goodwin of the Columbia Gorge Food Bank says they are always prepared to assist during disasters with ready-to-eat emergency food boxes and water. She adds many displaced families are living with relatives in hotels or camping and remain uncertain about their next steps.
It is difficult in a community of our size to absorb housing needs for that many families who have lost homes. And that is that next step of the recovery process of truly how are those families being supported with more long-term recovery efforts.
Breen says the food bank has been serving as a distribution site to hand out supplies from Adventist Health of the Columbia Gorge and other organizations who donated non-food items. That includes air purifiers, generators, hygiene supplies, and stuffed animals for kids. One of the biggest challenges, Breen adds, is keeping a supply of drinking water flowing once people start to return home.
We're able to drop full pallets of water directly into the impacted communities because most of the time the drinking water is no longer safe until enough testing has been done.
The Columbia Gorge Food Bank is one of 21 regional food banks in the Oregon Food Bank Network. Breen says the number of people visiting the food bank rose to about 6,500 per month during the pandemic and has remained at that level. People can visit OregonFoodFinder.org to find pantry locations in their area. I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service.
Use of Supreme Court of the United States emergency docket draws questions, and whistleblower emails expose a DOJ willing to defy federal courts. Meanwhile, Minnesota's red flag law shows early trends, and farmers and lawmakers sound alarms over privacy and trade. With that story and more, it's Farah Siddiqui with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times. In Minnesota, 71% of those orders were petitioned by law enforcement. I think that's interesting because that's actually lower than a lot of states.
Lisa Geller with the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Violence Solutions highlights early trends from Minnesota's red flag law, which lets courts temporarily remove guns from people deemed a threat. Used more than 100 times, advocates praise it for preventing suicide. Geller says the relatively low share of cases brought by police suggests it's useful for health providers and families. So far, the second Trump administration has asked the Supreme Court for an emergency ruling more than 40 times. The George W. Bush and Obama administrations did so only 8 times. University of Alabama law professor and former U.S. Attorney Joyce Vance says it's corrosive to use the shadow docket to increase presidential power, as when Trump's White House got permission to fire 1,400 Department of Education employees without congressional approval.
Instead of working to enhance public confidence in its integrity, the Supreme Court undermines it by taking these shortcut steps to issue substantive rulings.
Internal Department of Justice texts given to a Senate committee by a whistleblower show an assistant attorney general urging defiance of federal court orders. President Donald Trump's former personal lawyer, Emile Beauvais, told justice lawyers to ignore court orders the administration disagrees with. Beauvais has been nominated for a lifetime appointment to a federal appeals court. His nomination is expected to move forward in spite of widespread objections. Attorney General Pam Bondi is defying pressure for more Jeffrey Epstein transparency. The Republican Speaker of the House is calling for Bondi to release any files, although Trump continues to praise her. At a public meeting, Bondi focused on law enforcement wins, ignoring the charge that Trump himself may be on what's called Epstein's client list. Lawmakers in the Indiana legislature say they're angry about state agency profiting from personal data. Democratic State Senator Rodney Pohl says residents should have the right to stop the Bureau of Motor Vehicles from selling their information.
If you want to drive in this state, it's not as if you can go and get your license somewhere else. So at the very least, letting people opt out.
The BMV earns tens of millions annually by selling names, addresses, and vehicle details to third parties. While supporters say it funds agency operations, critics say stronger privacy protections are overdue. Rural economies are again on edge over Trump's trade strategy. Aaron Lehman, president of the Iowa Farmers Union, warns that the looming import taxes and the retaliation they would provoke would raise costs and hurt their sales.
That tariff raises the price for our product for buyers around the world. They're less likely to buy from us, and they're more likely to buy from some farmer from another part of the world.
Iowa exported over $13 billion in agriculture goods in 2023. Lehman says farmers and small businesses are bracing for ripple effects on the local economy. I'm Farah Siddiqui for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at Public News Service.
You are listening to KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report, The Texas Floods. At 6, it's No Quiet Hours. At 6:30, it's Free Culture Radio. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be a high of 97 and a low of 59. And tomorrow, it will be a high of 88 degrees and a low of 60 degrees. Today, in 1945, the United States tested the first atomic bomb in Alamogordo, New Mexico. The quote of the day is from Walt Whitman. He said, "Now I see the secret of making the best person. It is to grow in the open air and eat and sleep with the earth."
It's been more than a year since the Government Accountability Board released a study and issued recommendations addressing food insecurity among tribes. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. It's been more than a year since the Government Accountability Board released a study and issued recommendations addressing food insecurity among tribes. However, neither Congress nor the USDA have acted on them. Brian Bull of Buffalo's Fire reports.
In its findings released in July 2024, the GAO found that Native households were more than twice as likely to deal with food shortages or problems securing nutritious meals. Catherine Laren is the GAO's director. She mentions a few common factors.
Just the more rural and remote locations of tribal communities. They are harder to reach. There is less access to a variety of nutritious foods, and the cost of the foods is higher than often you find in more urban areas.
Among the recommendations the GAO has made is letting tribes administer more food and nutrition service programs and addressing dual participation in SNAP and food distribution programs. Marlon Skenendor is an Oneida Nation counselor who worked with the GAO during its research and surveying of tribes. He says traditional foods are important, but so is affordability and access.
Wild rice is super expensive now, and berries are getting up there. So it's all about direct access. I always think of an idea of how we can subsidize some of our traditional indigenous foods. And we kind of do that now. We have a tribal elder food box that happens twice a month that is mostly indigenous sourced.
The GAO's six recommendations are intended to improve knowledge of food security among tribal communities and improve services. But while Congress and the USDA have agreed with the recommendations, nothing has been done yet. Mary Green Trottier is a Spirit Lake tribal member who also serves as the director of the National Associate of Food Delivery Programs on Indian Reservations. She says studies and recommendations are fine, but now it's time to collaborate towards remedies.
We know the problems. We know we can address the solutions. We are boots on the ground, and just listening to our voices and utilizing that knowledge.
The USDA says it's actively working to address the GAO's recommendations, but did not address any specifics on a timeline. And two congressional committees that work in Indian Affairs did not return requests for comment. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
The Miccosukee Tribe of Indians of Florida is taking action in its opposition of the so-called Alligator Alcatraz, an immigrant detention facility in the Everglades. In a press release Tuesday, the tribe said it's filing suit as an intervening plaintiff in a case being brought by Friends of the Everglades, Center for Biological Diversity and Earth Justice. The suit's against the state and the federal government. The tribe's raising concerns over environmental impacts and safety. The tribe says the facility is on traditional homelands and near traditional Miccosukee and Seminole villages. In a statement, Chairman Talbert Cypress said, the Miccosukee tribe is committed to ensuring that ancestral lands in Big Cypress will not become a permanent detention facility. He says they've reached out to the state and federal government expressing concerns but have not heard of a closing date. So they're taking legal action. The Omaha Tribal Council has adopted a cannabis regulatory code to establish the first medical and adult-use cannabis system in Nebraska. According to a press release Tuesday, the tribe's asserting its sovereignty with the action and building a sustainable economy. The move comes after voters approved medical cannabis last year. The tribe says a phased rollout will begin this year. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Free vegan meals for people and the planet. Chili is on the Wheel serves up delicious plant-based multicultural dishes to people in need. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. You may not know who in your community is struggling with hunger.
It could be your next door neighbor. It could be your friend.
Eloisa Trinidad is with the nonprofit Chili's on Wheels. The New York-based group has built a network of chapters around the country that share free vegan meals. She says the food is delicious and healthy, and she says her chapter's menu represents different cultures.
Maybe we'll have Thai food one day, maybe the next day it'll be Indian food, maybe the next day it'll be Mexican food. We have a very diverse community, and so we really try to bring what the people want to eat.
The program provides food for people in need who do not want to give up a vegan diet, and it helps others learn about the benefits of eating more plant-rich meals. For example, how growing vegetables emits less climate warming pollution than producing meat and dairy.
When we distribute meals or fresh produce, they'll get a pamphlet on what plant-based eating is and the reasons why we need to move towards a plant-based food system.
But whether or not people become vegan, all can enjoy healthy food that's good for the climate.
We just welcome you in and we break bread together and we share a meal together.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Groups working for healthy oceans are calling for a pause or moratorium on deep sea mining for critical minerals until more is known about the potential environmental harms. Suzanne Potter has more on the story.
Conservation groups, including the National Wildlife Federation and Oceana, are calling for a moratorium on deep-sea mining for minerals until more research can be done on the potential environmental risks. President Donald Trump recently signed an executive order fast-tracking seabed mining. His goal is to boost the nation's stockpile of minerals like lithium, cobalt, and nickel used in cell phones, solar panels, and long-storage batteries. Dr. Jeff Schester with Oceana says it would be tragic to strip mine the seafloor without regulations to mitigate the harm.
You could essentially be eliminating huge ecosystems without even understanding what was there in the first place and without any possibility that these ecosystems can recover for centuries.
In 2022, California banned seabed mining in state waters. The International Seabed Authority has yet to pass meaningful restrictions and has already authorized some test mining in an area of the Pacific rich in polymetallic nodules called the Clarion-Clipperton Zone. The Trump administration has called deep-sea mining a core national security interest, saying it can't rely on foreign sources to supply these minerals. Shester thinks the U.S. government should take a more cautious approach.
The current administration's approach, there's really no recognition of the value of these ecosystems and the services they provide. It's really about how much money can be made in the short term to enrich the pockets of these large corporations.
He adds, deep sea research has the potential to help cure disease and to uncover genetic information that could help scientists understand the history of life on Earth. For California News Service, I'm Susan.
The Point Puzzle is a weekly puzzle. Every week, a winner from the last week will be selected from emailed answers and announced on air, and a new puzzle will be posed. Now for the puzzle with Pearl Stark.
It's time for the puzzle.
Last week, I asked you to send me a type of lake in six letters. Remove two letters, and you are left with a common visitor to a lake. Well, the answer is lagoon, which becomes loon. Our winner this week is Jeff Cook, who listens to KBOO in Portland, Oregon.
On the banks of Lake Temiskaming, there stood an old hotel that my father used to frequent, and the patrons knew him well. He'd spend the evenings drinking, always thirsty, could not quell. But we came just
for the new puzzle. Send me what these words have in common. Beady, apiary, cagey, enable, essence, and elementary. So again, what do these words have in common? Beady, apiary, cagey, enable, essence, and elementary. To see this list in writing, visit the Point Puzzle page of the KPOV website, kpov.org. When you have an answer, send your name, your answer, and the station in which you hear the puzzle to puzzle@kpov.org. I'll select one winner from among any answers received by this Saturday.
There's antimony, arsenic, aluminum, selenium, and hydrogen, and oxygen, and nitrogen, and rhenium, and nickel, neodymium, neptunium, germanium, and iron, americium, ruthenium, uranium, europium, zirconium, lutetium, vanadium, and lanthanum, and osmium, and astatine, and radium. And
this has been Pearl Stark with your Point Puzzle for the week of July 14th. The Point Puzzle is produced at KPOV, High Desert Community Radio.
Dan sees a new global order under deconstruction. Up next is Poetic Justice with local poet Dan Raphael.
Not so much that America is not what it used to be, but that the world has shifted. Money doesn't need a country anymore. One of the most significant developments of the later 20th century was money becoming electronic. It can be anywhere the guy with the password wants it to be. A couple of decades ago, deconstructionism was a big literary philosophical brouhaha. Now it's just a question of how deconstructed can we get? Big money is mostly illusory. A stock's value goes down when someone like Musk cashes a bunch in, but big money very concretely controls the prices of most of what we eat and need to survive. This is why Trump can continue deconstructing America's central role in the global economy, forcing other countries to find sources for their goods and business alliances without America. Interest will come due, and there will be penalties, mostly in the form of unemployment, prices, and shortages. What billion even knows the price of eggs or bread? It's an alien vampire invasion, since surely the uber-rich aren't human. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Josh Salem and Dan Raphael. The producer is Hannah Francis, and our engineer is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Mandy Stapleford, Farah Siddiqui, Pearl Stark, Isabel Charlet, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The interim evening news director is Hannah Francis. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Hannah Francis.
I'm Cheryl Denise. All our KBOO programs are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for an interview on the Texas floods.
I'm Roy Clark with WEFR Radio in Fairmont, West Virginia, and the Pacifica Network. And I'm speaking with Paul Cobbler of the Texas Tribune about the flooding that happened last week down in Kerrville, Texas. Paul, can you introduce yourself and bring us up to speed on the latest?
Hey, Roy. Thanks for having me. Yeah, I'm one of our reporters who's been covering the devastating floods in Texas Hill Country. Texas Hill Country is an area that is west, northwest of San Antonio and Austin in central Texas. It's kind of I had it described to me as sort of an elephant ear as far as the geography. Obviously, hills and rough terrain with a lot of river basins that flow through it. And they actually call this part of the state kind of running south to north Flash Flood Alley because